You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, we'll be celebrating the legalization of gay marriage in Germany, but why did the leader of the free world, Angela Merkel, vote against it? My guests Chiara Ramella, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including...
Well, what I wanted to talk about, Madam Deputy Speaker, and I apologize for wearing... the hideous tie again. It's come out of retirement for today and tomorrow and 3 days next week.
The UK's Parliament finally relaxes its dress code to ensure that politicians like the Conservative Peter Bone never have to apologise for their terrible ties again. But should Parliament really be a dress-down affair? We'll also check in with Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck at the Monocle Quality of Life Conference taking place in Berlin this weekend.
I think that people will leave today thinking, do you know what? Here's a list of things I can actually action over the coming days and weeks and months to make my life, my city's life, my company's life, my family's life that little bit better.
And we will ask why this man... might be adorning the tail of a Boeing 787 Dreamliner next time you take a flight on Norwegian. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle writer Chiara Ramella and Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan. And welcome all to our vaguely quality of life themed programme in honour of the Monocle conference of the same name, presently indeed occurring in Berlin. And seamlessly enough, today's first story is one that will improve the quality of life of people in Berlin and elsewhere in Germany who are gay and wish to get married. A clear majority of German MPs have voted to legalise same-sex marriage after Chancellor Angela Merkel dropped her long-held objections to such a vote, although not to same-sex marriage itself. She voted no. Fernando, first of all, in a case like this, what actually matters most? Is it a politician's personal opinions or how they conduct themselves? I guess it's that difference between intentions and outcomes.
Well, there are differences, but I have to be honest with you, I do care what a politician thinks about it. So actually, I'm very much disappointed with Angela Merkel and her decision. You know, to be honest, you know, she allowed her party to vote with their own conscience, so she didn't say that.
But she'd been against doing for a long time.
Absolutely. So, you know, for me it matters. So, for example, I would be potentially not a voter of Merkel if I would be German, because for me this is such a strong, I feel very strong about this issue. So I would like to know the view of the politicians. I think that's very important.
It would be a deal breaker for you. Absolutely. As a voter for her and her party.
It would.
Would it be a deal breaker though, I guess, if you knew that she was personally against it but had nonetheless made it possible for it to be legalised? Would you still consider that a reason not to vote for her?
I would still wouldn't vote for her, but I have to say, I respect her. I think that's better than, of course, not allowing her party to vote with their own conscience.
Henry, recent polls have showed 83% of Germans are in favour of marriage equality. This is just Angela Merkel thinking there's an election in September. This is not a fight you could possibly win at this point, except the inevitable.
Probably. I mean, I'm interested in hearing more about these conservatives within Germany that have managed to stem this vote so far, because they're clearly an extraordinarily powerful minority within Merkel's party. They have their hand on the tiller of that party when it comes to a number of issues. And, you know, when you cite the extremely high popular approval ratings same-sex marriage, it's kind of astonishing that they managed to keep it at bay for so long. And also, in a country which is going through as much as Germany at the moment, that they care about this issue enough to have done so.
This is where, of course, I have to admit that I am Australian, a country which, for reasons surpassing my understanding, has still not got with the programme. I'm not in this studio entirely alone in that, though, Chiara. Who is, of course, Italian. If you look at a map of Europe now, there's sort of this three stripes. Well, there was, actually, before Germany sort of ruined the geometric perfection of it by voting, yes. But the sort of the northwest stripe was for gay marriage. In the middle, it was sort of civil partnerships, but we're not really sure near. And then when you go east, it's like, no, we're not having it. Italy is still, I think, in civil partnership mode. Is there any chance that Italy will ever sort of move into the stripe on the left hand? This is a terrible, terrible way of explaining this in an entirely audio medium. You know what I'm saying.
I do know. Yes, I think Germany's decision has actually reignited some of the discussion in Italy. The same MP who fought for the law for civil partnerships last year, which eventually got passed only last year in Italy, actually, is restarting a conversation saying, you know, the left-wing PD should be reassessing the issue of same-sex marriage perhaps in the next legislation. But it's difficult in Italy because of all the connotations of the Catholic background. There's always going to be fairly widespread preconceptions and oppositions and fears as well within many across the political spectrum that voters just simply won't get on board, especially with the issue of adoption.
Andrew, what's up with Australia, though? Because I think, as you were telling me earlier, it's not exactly kind of like a burning cultural issue in terms of the country's religious background and whatnot.
At this point, I think we've just overthought it for so long that no one really knows how to outthink it. I would bet my house that if it was put to a popular vote tomorrow, it would win by a street.
But there's a squeamishness about doing that,
the argument in Australia in recent years has actually not been about whether we do it, it's about how we do it. There's been some question of should it be a referendum akin to the one they had in Ireland. People worry that that would be divisive. And there are gay people in Australia, good friends of mine, who get uncomfortable with that idea because it looks like they're being made a special case out of. And their argument is that the whole point is that we're not a special case and shouldn't be regarded as one. And that's why they would rather Parliament sort of tidied it up quietly.
Can I suggest an idea? I think something what happened in Brazil and the United States. I don't think the Parliament actually should vote for gay marriage. I think this decision is better for the Supreme Court to decide that. Because to be honest, in Brazil...
Take the politics out of it.
Absolutely. Because in Brazil, you know, we have a very conservative Congress. I think if our vote would be going through the Congress, we wouldn't have gay marriage. But our Supreme Court, you know, they're very liberal, very good, actually. That's one system in Brazil that is still a bit all right.
They haven't been arrested yet.
Not yet. So, you know, they approved. They say, you know, it makes sense according to the law. I think most countries should do that.
Is the movement, I'll just go briefly round the table, starting with you, Fernando, and then I'll proceed counterclockwise. Are we all confident, at least in terms of the Western world, that the movement on this is all one way? That this is one of those things that, say, people who are kids now, 20, 30 years from now, when they're adults, it's going to be like one of those things like, you know, I don't know, women voting or shops opening on Sundays. People will think, why was this ever anything anybody thought about?
It seems likely, but I don't want to say a definite yes, because I think we should watch out. You know, not all countries, even in the Western world, true, have gay marriage. So, you know, and even the fact that Germany approved, it's still such big news. I think we should be relaxed when it's not big news anymore.
When a country legalizes gay marriage and nobody cares.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I come from a country where very recently the discussion around having shops open on a Sunday was actually a hot topic. You know, this is a big deal. So I would hope that that's the unilateral direction. It seems impossible to think that it would be otherwise, but I know that there's way to go.
I think when it comes to kind of cultural prejudices and the direction they're moving in, it's difficult to know how far to zoom out when you're looking for historical precedent. Post-war, at least, racism seems to have been going one way, xenophobia a bit more up and down. I think this falls more into the category of, a linear trajectory.
Okay, well, let's look now at a potential improvement in quality of life closer to home, although one which is admittedly primarily of interest to members of British Parliament who dislike wearing neckties. Asked for a ruling after an MP dared to speak bare-necked, the Speaker of the House, John Bercow, ruled that, and I quote, as long as a member arrives in the House in what might be thought to be businesslike attire, the question of whether that member is wearing a tie is not absolutely front and centre stage. Kiara, are you especially bothered by what politicians wear to work?
Well, I'm bothered by what women are made to wear when they go to work. But aside from that, because I do think that there's an issue with the wearing of heels that we can talk about perhaps later. Ties, not that bothered. I like a little bit of neck.
Should there be some formality, though? As recently as 1998, I looked this up, a member of the British Parliament who wished to raise a point of order had to wear a top hat. And they did actually keep a couple of collapsible top hats on the premises specifically for this purpose. I'm not making this up. The last US president to be sworn in wearing a top hat was as recently as Richard Nixon. I'm not making this up. Fernando, at this point, I'm going to ask you to explain the emergency trousers.
Yes.
Which the Brazilian parliament, I believe, maintains. You may, of course, be making this up. I haven't had time to check.
I love that seamless segue there. By the way, we'll carry on.
The Brazilian parliament, I believe, like here in the UK, you know, if you're an MP or even a visitor to the Brazilian Congress, you need to wear trousers. You can't wear shorts. But the thing is, Brazil, especially Brasilia, can be very hot on a summer day. So the Brazilian Congress decided to install like a small shop close to the Congress where you can buy what I call emergency trousers. Basically, they're very cheap trousers. So it's even on the website.
Who goes to Parliament House and forgets trousers?
Well, our tourists, imagine on a 35-degree day, you're walking around Brasilia like, I want to visit the Brazilian Congress and you're wearing...
Well, so in the same kind of way that some mosques in the Middle East where there's lots of tourists and they know that there will be tourists who are, and it's hot, so they'll be wearing shorts they provide kind of robes and coverings, so...
Exactly. Okay. They're making a lot of money with those emergency trousers.
I like to imagine them being sold out of a vending machine in the form of a break glass in case of emergency capsule on the wall.
But I wish I would live in a world where MPs could work with shorts.
Andrew, I don't want to out you on air, but I think you've said to me before that you don't think any man over the age of 20 should be seen in a pair of shorts in any situation.
Except for the purpose of playing football.
Sportswear.
I think
no other context.
What about a nice pair of tailored shorts by Thom Browne?
I don't know. Wouldn't it be a bit weird? Should there be some level of formality? Should there not?
Well, I think I would advise all of our listeners to go online and watch the Speaker of the House, John Bercow's tortured ruling on this issue, because I think that it really brings to light the thinking behind dress codes in general. You know, there has to be. I think it's reasonable to expect a level of decorum within houses of parliament and legislatures. It's reasonable to expect what we call in parliament's parliamentary behaviour. The extent to which that extends to dress laws is obviously something which is constantly shifting, and parliament seems to be following society more generally at the moment. In I think divisions between different categories of clothing are blurring and changing the clothes in each category kind of equally. You know, I think probably one of the most visible examples of this phenomenon is the rise of athleisure wear, I think it's called, recently, the kind of blending of... Am I revealing my ignorance, Faye?
No, it's...
No, you're actually really right. Yeah. I mean, having been to Pitti Warmer only a couple of weeks ago, a lot of the conversations with the heritage brands revolve around the issue that even the people who make very classic suits are having to make much, much more relaxed suits and trousers that don't look very formal because people just don't want to wear them anymore.
What, of course, our listeners cannot see is that we are all impeccably attired in formal wear ourselves. Presenters of Monocle programmes are at all times spat, indeed. Fernando, you will have seen, as we all did last week or whenever it was, time has become meaningless in these strange political times. But last week, I think, was the Queen's speech with all the sort of bizarre, arcane ceremony attending it, the opening of a new parliament, etc. There is some value to that, though, isn't there? Some sort of connection with the past, some sort of reinforcement that there is a way things are done here, that this is stable, this is reliable, this will just keep happening no matter whether anybody understands why they're doing it anymore.
Oh, Andrew, I think you're playing with fire because I think I'll come out again as a Republican here. So, to be honest, I don't feel attached to the past. I have to say, I do like a little bit of camp, a little bit of fun in politics. I would add that, as long as it's a democratically elected person. But again, you know.
This is treacherous talk, Fernando.
Ooh, yes, I know. So I'll leave it to my other guests to see what they think of it.
I mean, can we, or should we, I'll ask you first, Chiara, judge politicians by the way they comport or deport themselves? Obviously, an obvious case in this country, the current leader of the opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, has made something of a virtue of the fact that he is a dishevelled man with a beard. It's hard to know whether that's a thing he's doing, whether he actually is just a dishevelled man with a beard. In the same way that it is popularly, in fact, not even popularly, quite authoritatively reported that Boris Johnson, the flamboyant foreign secretary, will actually literally adjust his hair depending on what sort of audience he thinks he's facing. If he wants to talk to sort of a young, cheerful audience, he'll do the fluffy, ruffled up things. But if he's speaking to grown-ups, he will plaster it all down.
I think it's disingenuous to believe that Jeremy Corbyn is completely unaware of the effect that his dress has on people. And I think there's a lot to be said about how subtly people can do this and how believable they are in their genuine kind of disheveledness. I appreciate when it is a part of the discourse and when it doesn't become the main thing that's purported about them. So, for example, I think Theresa May's leopard shoes have been made into too big an issue for what they should be. But less of a shiny watch coming out of a shirt, I don't mind that much. I think that's a good signifier, as long as they're subtle.
Henry, just finally on this, to return to the tie, which is where we came in, there has been a similar row in the National Assembly in France. Jean-Luc Mélenchon's far-left types turned up tie-less, causing a measure of scandal, and they made a rather laboured joke comparing, as they put it, the sans culottes with the sans cravats. Why does the tie, do you think, endure as this dividing line between the establishment and the radical?
It's an inherently absurd, I'm not even sure if it warrants the term, garment. I mean, I'm not sure when people started tying kind of a long strip of fabric round their necks.
We really should have looked that up.
Began being some kind of sign of formality. But listen, it's arbitrary, absurd and symbolic in the first place. It's inevitable that it's going to be played with.
My hunch, and I say hunch because I've literally just made it up on the spot, in the much the same way that John F. Kennedy killed the hat in the United States by not wearing one, I think Donald Trump will kill the tie with those absurd 9-foot long things.
By wearing them.
Although he does care about his tie a lot, because he wore that sticky tape at the back of it. So obviously he's worried about the tie not looking right.
Oh, this was going so close to being a Trump-free program as well. Anyway, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Chiara Ramella, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Coming up next, we will hear from Monocle's editor at this week's Quality of Life conference in Berlin.
What comes to mind when you think about Beirut? Edgy young designers and vibrant ready-to-wear collections might not spring to mind. Monocle Films delves into the fashion scene in Lebanon and meets the new talent in this melting pot of a city.
We've had a lot of difficulty here in Lebanon. We can't seem to unify and to improve ourselves. And this is because of the diversity of cultures that we have. I created a collection that was called Phoenix, and it was a kind of a message from me. We can be together and we can improve together.
Monocle's latest film on fashion is now available to watch on monocle.com.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Chiara Ramella, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Monocle, as we may have mentioned once or twice, is currently hosting its third Quality of Life conference. This year we are in Berlin. A little earlier we spoke to Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck to learn what it is that this year's event is looking to highlight.
I think what's great is we've had this kind of tension around the notion of urbanism for all. It's great to create cities that are for one generation or for one class of people. But the people here today, whether they're building high-end or low-end, whether they're thinking about mobility, whether they're thinking about health in our cities, they're all trying to work out ways that we can deliver a range of solutions to people across all ages and across all classes, and also make sure that the hearts of our city stay really diverse and mixed, and we get to rub shoulders with all sorts of people. So yes, we have got a bit of a manifesto coming out of today, and it's not all big crazy thinking. It turned out that many of the simple solutions were going to be the best, but I think that people will leave today thinking, do you know what? Here's a list of things I can actually action over the coming days and weeks and months to make my life, my city's life, my company's life, my family's life that little bit better.
That was Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck at the Quality of Life Conference in Berlin. Henry, Andrew was talking there about people making small changes to their everyday surroundings, those sort of small, incremental but accretional improvements. Can that really end up adding up?
I am very careful to avoid endorsing kind of big society arguments and letting governments off the hook for actually getting work done. I do, so I don't think it falls necessarily on private individuals. I do think that the owners of small to medium-sized companies, for example, can do huge things to improve people's quality of life, particularly in and around the workplace, which I'm sure I don't need to remind you or most of our listeners is where we spend, for better or worse, most of our waking hours. And I think the ergonomics of getting into and out of offices, you know, the kinds of behaviours that you can incentivize by putting stuff like, you know, showers, for example, in an office, you know, somewhere where people can have a shower after cycling in, will change people's behaviour beyond work, you know, how they get to and from work. So I really do think that there is very substantive stuff that, you know, people with a little bit but not a lot of power can do.
See, my only idea ever for improving things is just to, you know, issue on-the-spot fines to people who carry umbrellas. So I could probably stay out of this. Chiara and or Fernando, do you have ideas for small incremental changes to our workplace or our world that might make them all better for everybody, apart from fining people for carrying umbrellas?
Well, I'm thinking about a place that I went to very recently, just last week, Bucharest. It's a city that is enormously dominated by cement and streets and very little green space. And I think there's something that people are doing there that can teach a lot to cities that feel like they don't have enough park space, which is entrepreneurs are buying houses that are uninhabited and turning the back gardens into either bars or restaurants or spaces that can be used. Yes, of course, you have to pay to consume whatever it is that you're consuming there. But essentially reopening places that would have been residential and completely private and shut off. And I think for a city that doesn't have communal spaces where people can spend time together, that makes a huge difference.
Well, I was going to say, the only thing I could think of it when you mentioned quality of life was actually ice creams. And even this own company, on a very hot day, they do buy ice cream for us.
They do.
I think that's an improvement.
And just to clarify, the umbrella is a space. It's a space issue, right?
Don't start me.
Okay.
We've only got a few minutes left. There's an entire program in that. But finally, in today's Quality of Life special edition of Midori House, a massive bump in the quality of life for any imminent passengers with Norwegian Airlines, who are also huge fans of the bombastic rockers Queen, who I have been instructed to say are actually awesome. Those words were written by Tom Hall, the producer of this program, read under protests and lawyers, guns and money. In honour of what would have been the 71st birthday of Queen's late singer Freddie Mercury on September 5th, his image will be emblazoned upon the tail fins of two Norwegian aircraft. Norwegian make a regular habit of this, but Mercury is only the second non-Scandinavian non-aviator honoree. Can anyone guess the first? Well, you all can, because you've got the script in front of you.
Although that doesn't help me very much.
Is it Roldar?
No, he's Scandinavian.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, at least of descent. No, it's Bobby Moore, inexplicably, the 1966
that really is inexplicable.
World Cup captain, whose connections with Norwegian are a mystery to me. This is part of a thing Norwegian Airlines do. They put famous, well-known people on their tail fins, call them tail fin heroes. It is usually people who have either some connection with aviation or Scandinavia or both. In general, do we like this idea?
I really like it. I have flown on Norwegian a few times. It caught my attention straight away when I saw the plane on the tarmac. And they also provide, at the back of the in-flight magazine, Andrew, a very informative legend kind of showing all the different people and what they did, a little biography.
I really like that. One of the many, many reasons I dislike the Euro nearly as much as I dislike umbrellas is that I used to like going to European countries and getting that first fistful of money, and then you think, like, who are all these people on the banknotes? Why are they on the banknotes? And then you can look them up and then you can learn something. It reminds me of that.
Yeah, I think that's a nice idea as well. But I wonder why they're choosing non-Norwegian characters. But I think Freddie Mercury is an okay choice. I know you're not a fan, Andrew, but
I think it's to celebrate, right, their expansion or the extent of their growth in the UK. So they apparently he's going to be accompanied. I'm reading the press release here by four other, or is already accompanied by four other UK heroes, helping heroes. One of them deserves a special mention: Sir Freddie Laker, a aviation maverick.
Well, see, but there's the aviation connection, so that's logical.
But wait for it. So he basically pioneered low-cost aviation with a service called SkyTrain, flying between New York and London.
He did.
In the 70s. One of my favourite details of this story is that SkyTrain went bankrupt in 1982, owing over £250 million. And
we've
it's considered to be one of the biggest corporate failures in Britain at the time. The fact that Norwegian has chosen to... I love that. I'm not sure if that's deliberate or not, but it's a nice little bit of a...
Picky.
Yeah.
What I did want to do was ask this multinational gathering for you to suggest characters from your own homelands who you would like to see adorning the tail fins of your own national flag carrier. Starting with you, Fernando.
Can I choose three very quickly?
Oh, go on. Why not?
So I chose a former model, a former president and a former footballer. So I think I would go with Hulk, just because he's a very handsome Brazilian footballer.
Okay.
And he scored quite a few goals. And I think he would look good on a tail fin, I have
That's
to say.
Perfectly reasonable argument.
Yeah, I think I would choose as well Dilma, our former president, even though that might be a controversial choice for some. And finally, our top model, Gisele Bündchen as well. I think she did well for Brand Brazil.
Okay, apparently we can now choose up to three. So, Chiara, from the long, eventful and glorious history of Italy.
Well, I think my first choice is Italo Calvino, novelist, author of If One of Winter's Night, A Traveller, but also an essay called Levity, which I think goes pretty well with the tail fin and flying kind of theme. I have another literature person. For me, Primo Levi, from Turin, former chemist, and then novelist as well. But another person that managed to make a lot of levity out of a very dark and heavy subject. And then I'd like to choose a woman, Rita Levi-Montalcini, our scientist, another Turinese. So I think that's two Turinese out of three. I'm doing pretty well here. Obviously, Turin being my hometown.
That would cheer Alitalia's tail fins up no end. Henry Rhys Sheridan for Air Wales. Is there a Welsh airline?
I think it actually went out of business about 10 years ago. Nonetheless. I think you'll agree with me when I say that the more images of the face of Monocle's Toronto bureau chief, Thomas Lewis, that exists in the world, the happier I am.
Obviously.
And I think that he would look fantastic rendered on the back of a tail fin.
He would. So Thomas Lewis, you can have two others. Do you think it should be three different images of Thomas Lewis?
He's my first, second and third preference.
Okay. Well,
funnily enough, Norwegians started to fly to Buenos Aires directly. So may I suggest Eva Perón as well?
You may suggest Eva Perón. I mean, obviously, if I'm choosing for Australia and I can pick three, and I want the record to show Fernando had established the precedent of a football player. So I may be betraying a certain amount of bias, but I think Gary Ablett Sr., who played for Geelong in the 90s, would be a good choice. I think Joel Selwood, Geelong's current captain, would also be an excellent choice. And Patrick Dangerfield, our star centreman, would also, I think, be a superb choice.
You're not talking about real football here, are you,
Qantas,
Andrew?
Tail fin, all three Geelong players, purely coincidental, playing Greater Western Sydney tomorrow. Go Cats! That is all for today's show. My guests were Chiara Mello, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Thank you for joining us. And yes, we are playing out with this again. This show is being produced by Tom Hall, whose idea that was. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Day Achikala. Our studio manager was George McDonough. There's more music next at 1900. It's Marcus Hippie with The Menu, and I'll be back with more on today's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.